The other one you wanted to do is the Columbus with the Council of Italian American Society. All right, one of the things about Italian communities in the Northeast, with which I'm familiar, I think it's the same all over the country, and I think it's true also of other ethnic groups, certainly from Europe, is the, you know, the feet in both worlds. That probably with terms of the original immigrants, the vast majority of them, as I said earlier, from the Italians anyway, were illiterate. That was my mailman delivering in the box there, I think that was what that noise was. Anyway, and that persisted to the next, and probably the next couple of generations, so that, you know, the whole Freudian idea of seeking identity and all mingle into that. So that I, with my father's organizational experience, I mean, I naturally fell into organizational experiences naturally, I mean, not because they were going to help the law practice, but they usually do have that kind of an effect, but that isn't why. I mean, I joined, for instance, coming to Bridgeport, joined the Sicilian Society, because on my mother's side I was Sicilian, and then they're very provincial. Only people who could come would be spouses of Sicilians or Sicilians. I mean, that meant all other Italians also, or were excluded. Only Sicilians are. And that was called the Trinacria, what Virgil calls the island of Sicily in the Aeneid, the Trinacria, the three-cornered island, Trinacria.
How do you spell that?
Trinacria, not close, I think, is corner in Greek.
Trinacria.
Yeah. So, I joined that and became president of it at some point for a couple of years, and I joined the Italian American Civic Council, which was an attempt to join all the various societies. Italy, in the 19th century, and even at the time of the eventual unification in 1861, and then in 1870, when the Vatican States were brought into it. And because of the illiteracy and the lack of the level of education and the lack of economic prosperity, it was really a group of sections, very provincial. The mountainous terrain didn't help very much. There are mountains right down the back of the peninsula, not just the Alps up above, but the Apennines all the way down. So that the Italian expression, Italian sociologists talk about, is campanilismo. The campanile is the bell tower of the church. So there were units of society formed within the hearing of the bell tower. Campanilismo, all right? So this persisted when they immigrated over here, like Sicilian society, only Sicilians can belong, I think, that kind of thing. And then there were a lot of these societies in Bridgeport in the 30s and the 20s from the regions, representing the regions from which these people came. And so that right after World War II, it was an attempt to bring these societies together into one organization. And they call it the Italian American Civic Council, which, strangely enough, in terms of American history, was accelerated by the first celebration of the Barnum Festival Parade in Bridgeport, because some of the Italian groups joined to make a float in the Barnum Festival Parade, and that spurred activities to try to bring more of the groups together, all right? And that was back, talking 1948, 47, 49, I forget, 48. All right. And the formation of the Civic Council probably in 1950, and I joined that. spider? No, no. And that, again, money raising for its activities, we had to, we settled on the pre-Lenten period, the Mardi Gras, Tuesday or the Saturday before the Mardi Gras, I mean, because in terms of all activities have to take, by fiat, have to be on weekends, I mean, when people are not working. So so we had these winter fairs, if you will. We held them in the old armory. And then we were ousted from the armory because the armory was being redone or something. We went into one of the church halls. But that was to raise money for the activities of the Civic Council, to raise money to buy land in Newtown, which was done. And this persisted for some time until the early 60s when somebody got the bright idea that what good's it doing us out in Newtown? We ought to build something in the city. And that's, they used the Newtown land, which by then had increased in value. They sold it in order to gain money for buying land here and erecting a building, which they then they changed the name to the Italian Community Center of Bridgeport. So that's the Italian Community Center. Now, that, of course, as the Civic Council had failed to do, and as this community center also failed to do, it failed to establish a council of Italian societies. The Italian societies themselves were dying out anyway because the new generations weren't much interested. Television had come on the scene. Television was destroying a lot of the society, which had been male-centered. Friday nights they go play cards, the males. I mean, that's what these societies provided them. Plus the end of Prohibition gave the opportunity to have a club license, which cost a hell of a lot less than a restaurant license, but which was always, by all the societies, totally violated. I mean, they sold it to anybody, you know, but they're not supposed to. But, and that also was a money, you know, I mean, but it was still a male activity until World War II, and after World War II, television came in and slowly changed the American mores in that regard. I mean, so that helped in the dying out of the society as an organizational unit. So therefore, you know, you have a council of dying entities, what we were trying to do. So, but nobody ever gives up on that kind of a dream. And the Italian Community Center, you know, this great Italian-American culture. My brother, as a professor of literature, one of the things that the group of them who were Italians, they decided that there was a new culture. Well, it's more than just they, the sociologists too, that the Italian-American culture is a subculture, the American, and a subculture, the Italian. It is not either, but it is both. You know, that, and that's true. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's almost tautological to say it, but it's true. So this great cultural institution that turned out up there on Park Avenue really has only existed because of its athletic facilities. The cultural part of it and the unifying of the various provincial strains, this persistent dream kept slowly vanishing. And but it existed there. Then comes like 1976 or so, and I said I'd stop doing the International Institute. But throughout the years from 1913 on, Bridgeport always had a Columbus celebration. Now, in the 70s, there was one particular Columbus celebration that left a very bitter taste in the mouth, very sour taste in the mouth. The organizer of this small band that was going to celebrate Columbus, they always used to have the mayor come and speak or something. The mayor almost got into a fist fight with the organizer, and I thought that was very, very bad. and thought that, that we should do something about that. So,
okay, so
so that plus some of the older people who are no longer around, still with this dream of joining the societies and the Italian Community Center, and join. We had a meeting, I think, in 1978, in order to try once again this unification of the provincials. And out of that meeting, I mean, I said, you know, one of the things that holds the ethnic community together as a symbol is the Columbus celebration, the Italian St. Patrick's Day kind of thing. So, and I think that was horrible what happened the last time. So let's adopt Columbus Day as our celebration. You know, that's how that happened, really. And that really has become the principal focus of that council. It hasn't really succeeded in being a council. I mean, most of the, I mean, individuals that belong, but the only, in Bridgeport, sociologically speaking, you have the Sicilian group that still is alive, although they're not restricted to Sicilian by any means anymore. There's certainly anybody with any Italian connection that can join. The group from the Marche, which is in the center of the continent around Pescara, now Pescara is Abruzzi, Marche is a little is north of Abruzzi. The Abruzzi, the Marchegiana, the Marc Society, the Marchegiana Society is viable. And then some of the weren't provincial societies, really. That one of the things that grew when the University of Bridgeport, an attempt to expand its student base, began soliciting people from overseas, students to come, and one of the instruments by which they did that was to organize the Bridgeport ethnic communities to sponsor each of them a scholar to come to get a master's at UB. That was way back in the late 60s. And that much of that has died, especially when the Moonies took over the university when it was near bankruptcy. But the Italian part of it, that has persisted as an organization. And they still bring in a scholar, although we don't have the money for the whole master's program, but spends a couple of months here, the scholar does, at UB. But that's an organization, and that's an important Italian-American-based kind of organization. Some of the other, the remnants of the other societies, maybe you have people coming, but it doesn't really represent societies, it represents individuals, and we're going to change the whole bylaw situation and do something that, as a lawyer, I should have done long ago, make it a 501c3 organization, so that contributions are income tax deductible, and have individual members. Because really, that's what it is now. But it started out as another, in my 50 years almost here, another attempt to do what finally has happened in Italy because of World War II and because of television and because of more prosperity, but which in the Italian life that was represented here in the 1920s at the end of the immigration, it was kind of a frozen in history, the life that they were thinking about. You know, like my parents didn't let my sisters use cosmetics. They were born 1925, 27, 29, 35. Mm. They never used cosmetics. Mm. Now, but that was yeah. the country villages of Italy of the late 1800s. That's what they represented, and that's what the provincial societies in Bridgeport represented, what Italy represented then sociologically. And the process of unifying them has happened in Italy with movements that have nothing to do with what we can do over here, you know, and plus the whole business of the influence that tremendous the Americanization and American prosperity and literacy and education and so forth. Plus television. Television, great monster.
Great.
So that's really what the... And so we've run that now for almost 20 years. And we've managed to make a creditable Columbus celebration. I mean, we decided that in order to... We weren't going to just do the parade, but we're going to celebrate the all aspects of the Italian or Italian-American culture. So we had a Columbus Week is how we... We decided back in 1979, and we still, with some musical, some more scholarly lecture or equivalent display at the library, some kind of, we still do that. This year it took a different, a new tack. We decided we needed more money, so we sponsored a paid entertainer at the Klein, you know. So that, but it was built around this idea that, that Columbus was the symbol and the icon, and it was worth preserving it for whatever it was worth.
Thanks.
Basically, it. Yeah.
So. Let me just make sure that, would you think that it's right to say that your experience in the store with also contributed to the development of your sort of political
store
outlook, your experience with people coming to the store? And,
no question. Yeah. The store, and that kind of a community, and they existed all over, I mean, and not only in Italian communities of the United States, but in the other ethnic community. But certainly, the small store before the era of the supermarket, even before the era of the chain store, I mean, even though the chain stores had begun to exist, others, it was a community meeting place. Mm-hmm. And it certainly was an enrichment. One of the things, I'm quite fluent in Italian, having studied it, and I'm aware of Italian literature and whatnot, but one of the things that through the ear that I acquired, just as an example, listening to the dialects of the people who came in, now the dialects are themselves languages. They are languages that exist. Really, they exist because of the lack of literacy, because of the lack of communication. You know, mountain villages, and they kind of grow, and you could travel Italy, and there were the German philologists, there were sure there were others, named Rolf, who in the 20s, I think, he traveled up and down the southern Italy. And he could tell from the dialects the history of the peoples, the historical trends, who invaded when. I mean, you know, they all meshed, but you had linguistic isolation. And I get that reflected listening by ear to the changes of one crazy dialect that had a word for today and tomorrow, cry and biscry. Now, what the hell's cry and biscry? Well, cross and post-cross. Cross is tomorrow and post-cross is day after tomorrow in Latin. Mm-hmm. And this is what it came down to in the dialect after 2,000 years. You know, for instance, just to give you an example. Mm-hmm. So that was an experience that, except for the store, I would not have had. And I could, because of the store and because, you know, my own parents, when their people from their parts of Italy came and spoke their dialects, I'd also hear that. But the store would expose me to all kinds of peoples linguistically, well, also their own lives and their activities. I mean, now one per, and they'd come into the store, and it was just like the country store in the villages of New England, or not just New England, but from the 19th century country store. You know, they'd come in, they'd discuss now, there's a boy who started first year at Yale, but then he went to West Point. His name was Delano, but his father had been in World War One, and his father had been an Italian immigrant to Westport. He came from the Neapolitan region. His father, at that point, his experience, or maybe he came young enough, plus his experience for a couple of years in the Army, he got a Distinguished Service Cross in the Army, he was wounded. And he spoke English with practically no accent, but he'd come in and he'd discuss with my father, you know, they'd have big, long discussions. Other people would come in, you know, the store by no means was busy 12 hours a day, even though it was open 12 hours a day, or more. But all of these discussions people would have, they'd sit down, there'd be a chair right in the, you know, that's a, sure, that's very important, that there's no question about it. In terms of the fact that my mother was born in this country that was fluent in English, that's certainly another very important part of the reason why all seven of her children went to college, although my father was a great education buff, I don't. But certainly her being, you know, part of the American life stream. I mean, she wasn't a foreigner to America, even though she'd been back and forth a couple of times to Italy as a girl. You know, and an American-born, Italo-American marrying an Italian-born one, those marriages, and I've seen it, usually gave an advantage to the offspring that was not had by parents, both of whom had come, had been born overseas, you know. That those have to have entered into the making of whoever I am, you know.
Yeah. And just, I wonder if listening to the people's stories also is what sort of gave you your basic sympathies in life. For,
oh yeah, you always sympathize because everybody was an underdog. I mean, you, there were no rich people coming to the store, you know.
Well, it's been fascinating to talk with you, and I really appreciate your taking all this time.
Well, it's not quite certain what you do with all this, but I haven't. I know I've oral history in New Haven. One of the things that I do, I still maintain my New Haven contacts. But there are people connected with Southern Connecticut that have attempted and have put together some oral histories of the Italian community in New Haven. And Southern Connecticut itself has now got a kind of an ethnic archive, most of which is occupied by the Jewish groups of New Haven.
Really? Well, Jean Hickey, I think, is the main person, so she's got the Irish.
Yeah, the Irish are there, and the Jews are there, but I mean, and the blacks are there.
But not so much Italian.
Well, the Italians, they were part of the original forming group for the ethnic center, but they don't have that kind of documentation. And I think the Jewish group, better than all the groups, the people of the book, I suppose, but they have, there are books on New Haven Jewish history.
Right. That's interesting.
But anyway, I do know that even before that, the Oral History Project, although it was promoted by Southern Connecticut, the Oral History Project did develop some of the older Italians who are now dead who have been recorded in the Oral History Project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My partner's parents are in the same situation as your parents. She was born in the United States. They're both Italian Americans, and he came when he was four, younger, a lot younger than your father. But and they're quite elderly. He's in his 90s, and she's in her 80s.
Yeah. One of the great stories, it really doesn't have too much to do with your project, but as long as I'm on tape, I might as well, or on a disc. I go to New Haven in 1938, and I don't have any money, you know. But I had great entertainment walking around the streets of New Haven. I really learned the streets of New Haven. I was a little bit confused when they began to